you guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and this is the TechNet number 1699, if I got it right, of the TechNet that began September of 1982, 35 and a half or so years ago, let me think. Yeah, 35 and a half years ago. As you guys know, main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious radio amateurs gather here and teach each other the wireless art and science. There's an awful lot to be learned, and the books do a mediocre job, and the classes that teach wireless do a mediocre job, in my opinion. There's ways they could do it a hell of a lot better. They're stuck in the paradigm, the traditional way of doing it. Right after World War II, when the Radiation Laboratory series of books were written by McGraw-Hill, MIT, they had a certain way of presenting data, and not very much has changed since 1948 when that was done. Let me drop. And the professors who teach it only partially understand the material, so they're afraid to make any changes. And the course is taught in many colleges, the wireless engineering course, the fields and waves course, as it's called, the Maxwell's equations course, is taught as one great big memorization of matrix equations and manipulating those, and not very many real pieces of experience with rules of thumb of how to design and build and tune an antenna are really taught, in my opinion. Okay, the TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. First section, people sign in with their questions, and we take those in order if they have a question or a comment for the net. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS, who gives us the science and physics report. And then that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report, the latest on what NASA is doing. And we're making a slight change tonight, going back to a little bit what we used to do with, I even have trouble remembering Mel's call letters, K2KEY, Mel, and then later on John, KC2WGB. Would act as the mailbag gatherer, and Roy is going to do some of that function tonight, where the people who have been writing to him, he's going to be presenting them those questions to us during the first section. And so tonight I'm pretty sure we're going to be having a further discussion of Dave WA2SVN's questions on Yagi antennas. He's got some very good, very logical questions about that. And so a Yagi antenna is something... from my point of view, that's not well covered in the books. Yes, there's, let me drop. There are articles saying that if you cut the elements this long and if you mount them in these positions on the boom, you end up with a Yagi antenna on that particular band. Well, you can take a 2-meter Yagi that's published by QST, a 3-element 2-meter Yagi, or one that's shown on a YouTube video, and the dimensions of the spacings are very different. And the both a 3-element Yagi for 2 meters. What's going on? Which design is the correct one? That's the nature of John's first question. Correction, Dave's first question. So, I've already got Dave signed in, W2SVM. Anyone else who is pretty sure they've got a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now after the 4 beeps. K2RIW listening.
W2RIYGO, yes. If it gets in before 9 o'clock, otherwise I got to cut out.
We got Joe. Anyone else?
KC2, WTA, Joe, yes.
Okay, Whiskey Golf Alpha, we got you, Joe. Anyone else? Okay, and when we get to Roy's question, section on space science and physics, he's going to be going further with what he's been hinting about since last week. Not only do we worry about what is microgravity like in space, but quite a few things about what goes on with the International Space Station. We did already cover what percentage of the Earth does the astronaut see from the International Space Station. And many of us thought that he sees close to 50% of the Earth. And that he only sees 3% of the Earth, even though he's at 258 miles of altitude above the surface. 3% of the Earth's surface is viewable from the International Space Station, assuming there is no blockage at the astronaut's spacesuit window or whatever. In other words, you've got complete freedom at the International Space Station to look at the Earth from that altitude, and only 3% of it is within his field of view because of Earth curvature and his altitude. Very surprising answer. There's a lot of surprises about the International Space Station. Okay, one last call. Anyone who signed in with, who does have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. We've got more than enough to get going. Let's make sure that Dave is with us, WA2SVM. Are you there, Dave? From New Jersey. I can't think. Glen Ridge, New Jersey. Dave, give us a few words. KQRAW.
Good evening, KQRAW and the group. This is WA2SVM in Jersey. And question for this week is, I'm always trying to build a better portable Yagi, 2-meter Yagi antenna for field day and, you know, portable use. So I look at YouTube videos. I found one that looked kind of interesting, a simple type design, and followed it. And at the end of the video, the guy was doing a demonstration, and I noticed that the element spacing looked a little weird, peculiar to me, that the reflector was closer to the driven element versus the director, which was farther away from the driven element. So the YouTube poster referenced an article from 1993 QST magazine. If anybody wants to follow this, on my QRZ page, WA2SVM, I have two links there. You can see the YouTube video and the article that he referenced. In any event, I looked at the article, and the diagram that was provided looked the same as what the gentleman built, which looked to me incorrect. It's like the reflector was closer to the driven element versus the... let me drop it a second. Yep, it was closer to the driven element versus the director, but yet there was a photo in the article, which you can see, where it looks like it's built correctly. And so the gentleman was doing a demonstration, and obviously it worked, so he had a nice vertical dipole, and I guess some kind of directivity. I'm not sure what, but I'm not sure it was exactly what the design should have been. So I just questioned whether that's normal, if there's any time where the reflector could be closer to the driven element, and or is that a mistake? To me, it looks like a mistake, but it may work. But that was it. Back to you, Dick. Thanks.
Yeah, those are very logical questions, Dave, where you see those differences, where those two designs have various spacings between the reflector and driven element, and driven element and director. And so one article versus the other, it looks like the spacings are inverted. And it would be nice to believe that there is a single design of a Yagi antenna for 2 meters, and that everybody should be following it. Not at all. On top of that, the way a Yagi behaves is kind of different than common sense. The Yagi parameters, now how accurate you've got to make things, are a weird mixture of things that are critical and not critical. In the case of building a three-element Yagi, which we'll be discussing, there is a better article, in my opinion, which I've indicated to Roy, and eventually you'll be getting a copy of that, Dave. The so-called tape measure Yagi three elements is, in my opinion, a hell of a lot more robust, easier to tune, broader in bandwidth. When you make the elements very skinny out of 14-gauge wire, the elements for a 2-meter Yagi, you end up with an antenna that's not very robust. It's very easy to damage it in transit. They bend too easily. And because the elements are so short, so small in diameter, the tuning becomes more critical and the bandwidth becomes a little bit more narrow. Let me drop it. But to really find out what is critical and what is not critical, if you were building, say, a 16-element Yagi on 2 meters, as you make the number of elements greater and the Yagi becomes longer, what becomes critical and what becomes non-critical becomes more and more obvious. In the case of a 16-element Yagi, if you were building one of those, all of the parasitic elements should have a length accuracy of better than an eighth of an inch. But the placing of each of the elements on the boom can easily have an error of plus and minus 1 inch or more, and nothing bad would happen, as long as the error is not cumulative. So if you randomly place the elements on the boom, an inch plus or minus an error in position, but you got all the length to the nearest eighth of an inch or better, you'd get nearly full performance. Craziness. And by the time you get to down to a 3-element Yagi, even the criticalness becomes a little bit less critical. So which of those two designs is the right design? Both designs are a good design. Neither one is better than the other. They're both good designs. There's a compromise when you're tuning a Yagi between getting the best gain when you're tuning it, element length and element positions are what you're varying, let's say for instance 3-element Yagi, and you're simultaneously looking at the standing wave ratio of the driven element. Let me drop. As you change the spacings of reflector and director and the length, the standing wave ratio goes up and down. At the same time, the gain goes up and down. They do not track each other. It's a compromise. The best gain is not the best visuar, and vice versa. So each guy of those two articles settled on certain positions in lengths that gave him an acceptable visuar. Acceptable visuar is something like 1.3 to 1, 1.4 to 1. A guy who has a lot of Yagi experience goes the next step. He tunes his elements, whether he's building a 3-element Yagi or a 16-element Yagi, he tunes the element lengths and positions to maximize the gain, assuming he's using a high-performance antenna range, one that can really resolve 0.05 dB of difference, so he knows which when he's going in the right direction. An antenna ratiometry, antenna range, is capable of giving you that resolution, even when you've got the reflection going on in the backyard off the lawn, and even though the lawn is drying out and the reflectivity of the lawn is changing between morning and noontime while you're doing the tuning. A ratiometry antenna range, which is a article in QST magazine, I think it's 1975 article by KQRIW. You look at the ARRL archives on their past articles and look up KQRIW's article, you'll find that. And so with that antenna range, you can tell, as I said, 0.05 dB of resolution of gain improvement or detriment. Let me drop. So a Yagi antenna maven would tune for the best possible gain, not worrying about standing wave ratio. Once he gets the best possible gain on the tuning of lengths and positions of all the elements, then as a separate procedure, he goes and corrects the standing wave ratio of the driven element without changing anything else with the parasitic element. The driven element only has to radiate like a dipole and give you a good impedance match. Its exact length is not a critical portion of the antenna's gain. And so there is an article that's in both of the Mic Number 1 and Mic Number 2 websites. Mic Number 1 is the website called amateurradio.tangovictor. And in there, near the bottom of the page, you'll see a white square talking about the K2RIW antenna tuning procedure, Yagi antenna tuning procedure. If you go to Mic Number 2's website, which is limarktechnet.com, the very first article there is the RIW article. Anyhow, once you use the tuning procedure, which is unknown to most amateurs, there is a crazy tuning procedure for a dipole of any Yagi or the dipole by itself, where you can make the standing wave ratio absolutely perfect, 1.000 to 1, by using that very simple tuning procedure, which is a little bit illogical. But the article explains that. Let me drop. So therefore, a really smart Yagi tuning maven would first tune the Yagi for best gain, then he applies the procedure to get the best possible standing wave ratio of the driven element. Once you do that, you now have an optimum Yagi. It is best on gain, if that's what you want, or best on front-to-back ratio, a slightly different tuning, if that's what you want, or best for first side lobe level, if that's what you want. But after you select the tuning procedure that favors whatever you think is the most valuable parameter, then once you settle on that design, You don't worry about what the standing wave ratio is, within reason. And then you use the tuning, the separate tuning procedure for the driven element to make the tuning, the standing wave ratio perfect. Now you end up with the best of both worlds without allowing one parameter to contaminate the other. So to answer Dave's original question, which design is the good design? They're both good designs. And if you completely ignore the standing wave ratio compromise while you're doing the tuning, let me drop. You'll come up with the best gain. But when you are looking for the compromise of best gain and best standing wave ratio by the conventional tuning simultaneously, you're not sacrificing more than 1 or 2 tenths of a dB of gain. So it's not a big difference. A three-element Yagi well-tuned, giving you something in the vicinity of 7 decibels of gain over isotropic. And so whether you do or don't worry about the standing wave ratio simultaneously, makes another 2 tenths of a dB of gain. But you can get the benefit of that other 2 tenths of a dB if you don't worry about standing wave ratio and apply that standing wave ratio tuning as a separate procedure later on. But now, of those two designs, they're both equally good. Let me drop. But in my opinion, what I've given to Roy, and he's probably going to put it up. I know he's going to put it on his website. These articles about the tape-free element 2-meter Yagi tape measure. Use 1-inch wide tape or 3/4-inch wide tape measure tape. That yellow thing with a bunch of 1-inch markings on it. You make a Yagi out of that. You end up with higher performance. The tape measure Yagi has a lot of history. It's been used for years by people who are doing portable GFing operations and field day operations. And it's a more robust antenna. You don't worry about taking these skinny little elements and bending them and eventually breaking them off. The tape measure Yagi, you can easily fold it up for storage, and then it pops out automatically, if you know what I mean. It's a much nicer Yagi to build. It's again done with a PVC tubing for the boom, very inexpensive materials, and that particular antenna is, in my opinion, prettier looking, higher in performance, more robust, has a lot of very good history. So, over to you, Dave, for some fills on all of the above. K2SVM, some darn good questions you've been asking. K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Dave. Wait for the beeps.
Well, thank you so much for that. I'll surely look into your article and other things to get me in the right, better direction. I'm using something built out of PVC pipe tubing right now, combination of things, and one of the hard times I'm having is getting the driven element to match it, have it match nicely, so that's why I was looking around for some other ideas for doing that. It's like doing like a delta match. I tried that, didn't work so well, and then just running the coax, you know, with splitting the elements like a dipole, that wasn't so 30, so I'm looking, you know. But I have a better idea for that now. But your ideas are great. Thank you, and commentary. I have an antenna analyzer, so that can certainly help me with the trimming and tuning of the antenna. I'm mostly interested in the gain, not so much the front-to-back stuff and side lobes or whatever. Mostly gain, front-to-back gain. And so we'll see. I'll read up some more, do some more research. I have the antenna book manual and a few copies of the handbook here to help me as well. And, of course, I could always purchase an antenna, but that would be the easy way out. I can't do that. We have to make it. So I'll keep fooling around with it, and if I get something that I like really well, I'll try it out here at home and test it out on the TechNet one night. Back to you.
Yeah, I've explained quite a bit of this in writing to Roy. And I guess I should ship you a copy of that writing, which gives you more of the very specifics of what I just told you. But when you say you are not happy with the impedance match you are getting, does that mean you are getting something like a 1.8 standing wave ratio and you'd like it to be a 1.2? Are those the kind of numbers you are getting, Dave? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can't say I even got it that close. It was never very good. At least trying to do delta match where you use the little loop of 75 ohm cable, and I forget what the wavelength is of the loop that you use. I've tried that, and that didn't work so well. So then I just tried it just as a straight dipole and tried to trim it, and I don't think I might have gotten that pretty good, tuned pretty well, but then once you have it mixed with the other elements, like you were mentioning, it didn't seem to maintain that good match. So we'll see. I'm not sure what the best way will be. I haven't attempted to try to build a gamma match. Obviously, they probably work very well. What are your thoughts on that?
The nice thing about a gamma match is that it gives you two parameters. You can tune the length of the gamma rod and the capacitance of it, and therefore, in theory, you can get a perfect impedance match. But whether you use gamma match, delta match, T match, any of the matching procedures for a driven element of a Yagi or the dipole all by itself, when you follow those procedures that are in those two mic number one and mic number two locations, the so-called K2RAW tuning procedure, which is a well-kept secret, it's hard to believe that when you adjust nothing but the length of the driven element, nothing but length, you can make the resistive components of the impedance anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive. If you want the resistive component to be 47.34 ohms, choose the right length and you will get that resistive component. Longer is higher impedance, shorter is a lower impedance of the resistive component. However, no matter what method of feeding the Yagi you're using, the driven element, any of those deltas, T's, gammas, whatever, once you settle on the right length that gives you the resistive component that you want, 98% of the time you're going to have some reactance left over that's going to aggravate you and make the biswar high. The separate procedure, there's a way you can now make the reactive component go to zero, and therefore you can have your cake and eat it too. The exact resistive component you want, which might be 50 ohms, if you're using 50 ohm coax, and the reactive component can be made to go to zero. And I'm amazed that article is so well unknown, but as I said, in both mic number one and mic number two's location, you can read that article, find out how to do it, and within the next week or two, you're going to have whatever physical design that you prefer, whether it be the tape dipole that I recommend, or the follow-through and the one you've got, but you're going to get the performance you want with the standing wave ratio simultaneously. So, good news is on the way, Dave.
Repeater, time out.
So, by the time you get to the bottom of all this, you'll have much more understanding of how a Yagi works, how the driven element works, how the parasitic elements are, what they're really doing, and how to make it all come out right, physically and electronically. So, I'm pretty sure we'll be hearing reports from you in future weeks of pretty good news. If not, you'll tell us what you saw, and we'll suggest what to do next. Next person on our list was Joe, W2RYY. How are the electrons treating you this week, Joe? You've got it, Joe. K2RIW.
Hang on a second. I'm going to pull my chair in front of my radio so I can sit down and talk to you at the other side of the room. Just a minute. Okay, ready to go here. This is kind of unusual with the type of question. It has to do with propagation. I recently just got another state in TV DXing, one I haven't had before, which happens to be Savannah, Georgia. I got two different TV channels about a week and a half ago, almost 2 weeks, close to that, when we had those, just before we had those hot days where it was like over 90 degrees in the city. On RF-22, I got WCJL in Savannah, Georgia, and RF-28, I got WTGS, also Savannah, Georgia. My question is, how does that type of propagation work for such an incredibly long distance, yet you can't see something short by maybe 100, 200 miles? Because I checked other channels shorter than that, like for South Carolina or North Carolina or so forth, and I wasn't getting anything short of that, just these two particular channels at that particular time. Don't you think it's a little strange?
Yeah, tell me once again, now, what was the RF frequency channel number on those channels, Joe? Go ahead.
RF-22, and it was also a DT-22, WCJL, and RF-28, also DT-28, WTGS. They both come back to a transmitter site west of Savannah, Georgia. And those channels are no longer occupied locally, like CBS used to use RF-22 at a ridge. They're off the air. They're not there anymore. NBC used to be on RF-28. They're not there either. So that's probably what accounts for me having a cleaner frequency to be able to receive these on.
Doing some quick mathematics here to find out the channel 22, 470 ad, starts at 518. So the next question is, could sporadic E operate at 518 megacycles? Not so likely. So it's not sporadic E propagation is my guess. However, there's various ways that a signal could give you a long-distance propagation. I mean, for 4.5 solid years, I used to talk to K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, exactly 480.2, something like that, miles, airline miles from me, 480 miles on 432 megacycles, single sideband between me, K4CAW in Greensboro, 200 miles inland in North Carolina. And I could talk to him every Tuesday night, 7:30 to 8 o'clock, summer, winter, spring, and fall. We're running a kilowatt on both ends, single sideband, 432. I was running 16 Yagis, he was running 4 Yagis, both using 100 feet of tower. So 480 miles, and we're only running a kilowatt. A broadcast station runs a hell of a lot more than a kilowatt of effective radiated power. So 480 miles is there. However, we were experiencing 260 dB of insertion loss. In other words, these were threshold signals, moon bounce-like signals on sideband that we're hearing of each other. You wouldn't get good enough TV reception out of that, even with digital television. Let me drop it. It turns out a signal over the horizon is always there. The only trouble is to ask, is it strong enough for you to get it above threshold of your receiver? Are you using enough transmitter effective radiated power? Are you using enough receiver effective capture area to receive enough of the signal? Because that signal is continuously scattering by atmospheric inhomogeneities, among other ways. In other words, there's little hot spells and whatever of the atmosphere, so the signal, within the first 6 miles, the signal hitting that atmosphere is being scattered because the air is never completely uniform. Also, aircraft reflection is something we experience an awful lot on 432. I'm pretty sure you're not getting the aircraft reflection when you get it over the horizon like that. It only lasts for about 2 minutes. Is the airplane in the right position, if you know what I mean. So that propagation you're experiencing, Georgia to you, I'm guessing is approaching, what, a healthy 800 miles. That's not an easy one to explain. You see this how often, and it lasts how long, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet.
At the time. On my notes here, I wrote those two channels I received on 5/2/18. And I got a bunch of other channels a week or so later on 5/9/18, all coming back from the either Virginia or Washington, D.C. area. I got several channels I've never got before. And I also checked the other channel. At that time, I checked RF-22 and 28. I got RF-28 out of Maryland Public Television, and nothing on RF-22. So the conditions change from time to time, and it's very crazy. RF-22 is, I think, 5/18 to 5/24. And LS should be 554 to 560. So it's in different parts of the UHF band. Funny thing is, there was nothing open on VHF, like on the open channels, channel 9, RF channel 9. And RF channel 12 that I could see. So it seemed to be pretty much restricted to just the UHF part of the band. But I tell you, RF can do some very, very strange things from time to time.
It sure can. My best guess, what will favor UHF more than VHF, is pretty much what I see on 10 gigahertz. and that's going to be super refraction. By that I mean, particularly late at night, when you start getting dew forming, particularly in the summer months, for instance, where you get a layer of high moisture air down low and dry air up top at a higher altitude. The water has got a dielectric constant of 81. Therefore, water vapor in the atmosphere is a slow wave structure. The signal travels through water vapor more slowly than it does through dry air. And as such, with that radiation of high moisture down low and dry up high, you get a downward bending of the wave, the so-called 5/8 wave phenomena during normal conditions. So late at night, on 10 gigahertz, almost every 24-hour day, you're going to get an opening on 10 gigahertz, a band opening by the super refraction phenomena that I just described, the downward bending of the wave. And so, on 10 gigahertz, you'll see a band opening some portion of every 24-hour day way beyond the horizon like this. That's what I think you're seeing. And it favors UHF over VHF. This is a downward bending for a whole bunch of reasons. So that's my best guess. Forward propagated tropospheric scatter super refraction is what I think you're seeing. I presume that signal was in there for not just seconds at a time, but good fractions of an hour at a time. Is that true, Joe? The B2RYY, K2LAW.
Yes, actually, it's kind of funny. I just happened to had to get up early that day, fairly early. I was up about 3:30, 3:45 in the morning. That's when I caught these. After a warm day, it cooled off somewhat at night. Maybe just starting to be on the edge of starting to change or warm up the next day. That's when I caught those two channels. I can't see much about it. You're right. Savannah, Georgia is quite a ways down. Could totally skip South Carolina. And that is the farthest East Coast state I've gotten so far. I haven't gotten Florida, but you never know.
I think it's just a matter of time, Joe. We're waiting for the right weather conditions and the right time of the year. You will eventually hear Florida. I remember hearing Florida at 432 on a couple of occasions, 432 sideband, for a couple of hours at a time. In fact, on one particular occasion, it lasted for almost a day and a half. So it's just a matter of time. You'll see that. And super refraction, I think, is what it is. When that downward bending of the wave follows Earth curvature, a signal 400, 600, 800 miles away from you will sound like it's in your backyard. When you get that downward bending, see, ordinarily a signal coming out from your antenna is simultaneously spreading in azimuth and in elevation. That's part of where the inverse square law comes from. Okay? If the signal has this downward bending that follows Earth curvature, you're still being scattered in azimuth, but you're not being scattered in elevation. You're being focused in elevation. So it starts sliding from inverse square law to inverse linear law. And all of a sudden, you get some very strong signals over very large distances. That's what I'm guessing is happening, Joe. So I'm envious of you having the ability. Let me drop it. To do all this television DXing. Because of my own laziness, I haven't got around to putting my television antenna on a rotator, on the tower, with a good preamplifier, so I can start doing this also, because I am also curious. And so, the best beacons for UHF ham radio, the best beacons in the world, are television broadcast stations, because they run rather high ERP from very good locations, and they're scattered all over the United States. So if you want to know, is there a band opening to Texas, just choose a good Texas television station, aim in that direction, tune to that frequency, and see if they're there. You'll know if there's a band opening in Texas right now. So, good luck with that operation, Joe. Back to you for any final. To the A2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
I don't remember if I have to check my camera to see if I took a picture of the screenshot with the converted tune to that channel and the approximate signal level coming in. I don't remember if I did. I may have done that. But the programming was on there for quite a while before it faded out. I think it was on there for at least an hour or so.
So it wasn't just a quick type of thing. It went up and lasted for quite a while. Because the program on one of the channels, I think it was on RF-22, whatever the program was, is like, you know, this guy that's buying used, you know, like muscle cars from the 60s, something like that. So the programming I haven't seen up here. The programming or content being covered was completely foreign. I haven't seen it covered carried by anyone up here. So I was pretty assured that I was getting the right thing. And the core letters matched up in the header information also. So I know. Good luck with TV, actually. Dick, you got to get an antenna with a rotor up there. You're missing so much fun.
Yeah, already you're making me feel jealous. Gotta do something about that. Next person on our list was Joe, KC2WGA, Whiskey Golf Alpha. What would you like to discuss tonight, Joe? You got it. KC2LAW in the tech net.
Good evening, Dick. And the call was KC2WTA, Whiskey Tango Alpha. And I'm one of Roy's people from the KCRC Club. And I'm going to be doing an alignment on a realistic DX 160 general coverage receiver. And I need to make an IEC dummy antenna. And the diagram and parts values are available on the web. And I'm going to let drop. Okay, and Dick, if you were going to construct this and you had your choice of etching a printed circuit board or using perf board or using terminal strips and doing a point-to-point wiring construction, which one would you prefer?
Yeah, there's a lot of missing information in your question, Joe. Are you talking about the printed circuit board that builds the low noise amplifier? Are you talking about the substrate you use for building a VHF/UHF antenna? You said you're building yourself an IDC dummy antenna, which is something I'm not familiar with. So what is it you're constructing? What approximate frequency range, in other words, center frequency and bandwidth, are you looking for? And you called it a dummy antenna. Does that mean it doesn't have to have real gain to the outside world? It's just a dummy loading device? So as you can tell, there's a lot of ambiguity in the original question. Back to you, Joe. KC2, Whiskey Tango Alpha, K2LAW.
Oh, yeah, I can understand that, Dick. I've never seen this before myself. And they're calling it a dummy antenna. Basically, what it is a impedance matching network that you place between the RF signal generator and the antenna terminals of the receiver that you're working on. It's a series parallel combination of resistors, capacitors, and inductors, and it has an input and an output. And it seems to be that it would be in a metal enclosure because the circuit is has a dashed outline that runs through the outer rings of the connectors. So this is just, it's composed of one inductor, two capacitors, and two resistors.
Sam, want to comment?
Go right ahead with the comment.
RIW in the group, WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Joe, are you talking about an RF attenuator so that you may attenuate the signal from the RF generator down to a calibrated level that you can then use in the receiver, WB2GXM?
No, this is intended to match the output impedance of the RF signal generator to the input impedance of the radio that you're working on, so that the radio circuits aren't detuned.
Let me drop for a second. What's a little bit confusing here, Joe, is that a well-designed signal generator is automatically a good impedance match. If it's a single generator made for 50 ohms, it is a 50 ohm source. Now, maybe your particular television receiver is made to listen to a 75 ohm cable or maybe 300 ohm twin lead. So is this device trying to match a 50 ohm single generator to a 75 ohm input impedance of the receiver under test? Is that part of what's going on? KC2 Whiskey Tango Alpha, K2LIW, wait for the beeps.
Yes, Dick, this is the realistic DX160 has a following. People like it, but it's a low-end receiver, and it has screw terminals, and it's a 300 ohm input.
Okay, that's making a little bit more sense. So, if this is the best of all worlds, your 50 ohm, we'll say, signal generator, which is an unbalanced signal generator, in other words, it's a coaxial cable. In the best of all worlds, it's going to go through some kind of a balancing device, making the unbalanced coax input be a twin lead output with a 300 ohm impedance and with a known insertion loss, which you can use as a calibration factor. Now, if you're building that at UHF television frequencies, numbers like 4, 5, 600 megahertz, you've got to be a little bit careful with that layout. It could be done on any of the procedures that you're describing. It could be done on perf board. It could be done on printed circuit board. With proper layout, you can even do it on a piece of Mylar with pieces of copper tape, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot of different ways of doing it. Is one better than the other? It's a matter of your skill and the particular design you're following. The best way to do it, in my opinion, would be to choose somebody. Let me drop. Somebody's design that has some track record to it. If somebody has a design that has been often duplicated and it's easy for you to duplicate, that's a better way of going rather than trying to use your antenna analyzer, for instance. You might have a 50 ohm antenna analyzer that maybe goes to these UHF frequencies, and if you had a known very good 300 ohm resistive load, you could put on the output of this balancing device and then measure the standing wave ratio accuracy on the 50 ohm input end. That would be one way of testing this out. But still, you'd like to have some way of measuring the real insertion loss. Following somebody else's known good design is my first recommendation. A person with a whole lot of skill at building these kind of circuits could do it any of the ways that you described and make it work well. But for a person without all of that previous apprenticeship and experience, doing it the first time yourself without following somebody's known good design, you could get yourself into a little bit of trouble. The worst that will happen is you'll have some excess viswarm and some unknown insertion loss, which will make your sensitivity measurements look a little bit pessimistic. I would just choose what you think is the best design with history, dive into it, and even if it doesn't work out perfectly, there are ways of fixing it later. And what you're building is not expensive. It's not the end of your resources, the end of your fortune, if you know what I mean, if it doesn't work the first time. KC2WTA, drag your feet a little bit in case anyone else has a suggestion for you, Joe. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2WTA gets the window suggestions. Yeah, this is just a very simple thing, Dick. I've never seen it before, and I scoured the web looking for this thing, and I haven't found anything. So, yeah, I'll just dive into it head first. It's really no big deal. It's just I've never seen this before. I've aligned a lot of radios, a lot of high frequency receiving sets, and AM broadcast sets, and sometimes when you just come up against something you've never seen before, you kind of brick wall it. So, all right, thanks very much for the help, and this is KC2WTA on the side.
Joe, the impedance matching device that you're about to build, what is the source of it? Is it an IEEE article, or is it a website article? Do you have a design that you're about to follow, and from your point of view, is it coming from an authoritative source? Back to you, Joe.
Well, it's actually in the service literature for the radio, and it's a very clear diagram. I'm a draftsman, and I've been reading diagrams, electrical and mechanical diagrams, for years, and I'm a builder. I've been fabricating stuff for years. I've got half a dozen guitar amplifiers under my belt that I've fabricated from scratch. So this is really nothing. I just wanted to get a pointer on what kind of material I should use in building this thing. It's an RF circuit. I've never done that before. But yeah, there's no big deal here, Dick.
On UHF RF circuits, as long as you keep all the leads very short, neat, and all the leads very short, don't make it look like a dead buck design or a rat's nest, if you know what I mean. Stray inductance and stray capacitance can give you some grief. Where the radio itself that you're tuning has this recommended circuit to be used between your signal generator and that radio, that's a very good possibility that's the right way to go. They've been down that road. They want their radio to perform well, and therefore they probably recommended a pretty good circuit. So I'd have quite a bit of faith on that one. And hopefully they've given you a picture as to what it should look like when it's finished, and so you can make your layout look like theirs, and most likely you'll get the same performance they got. Now I'm going to go over to Roy, AC2GS. I think you've got other mailbag submittals that you've received over the week, Roy, that you're going to bring to our attention at this time. AC2GS, with the mailbag section of the TechNet, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone. Yeah, we have some questions for the actual mailbag. And I'll start you up with one of the older questions that I've had sitting there in the bag. A gentleman was curious if anyone ever tried, he's familiar with frequency modulation and amplitude modulation. He was wondering, has anyone tried polarity modulation, modulating a signal by changing the polarity of the radio signal itself?
And your original question is, has anyone tried it? The answer is yes. Does it work? Sort of. Is it desirable? Probably not. Let me show you what I mean. Let's assume now that I've got a receiving antenna that's within line of sight of a transmitting antenna. And the receiving antenna is a linear antenna. Let me make it a simple vertically polarized ground plane antenna. And now I've got a transmitting antenna a mile away, line of sight. And the transmitting antenna has polarimetry capability. In other words, I can transmit a signal horizontal, vertical, and everything in between. As I slide from vertical polarization on transmission, where I get full amplitude into the receiver, and I slide toward horizontal polarization, where I get complete nulling of the signal into the receiver, I obviously, at the receiver site, can create amplitude modulation by doing nothing but polarization modulation at the transmitter. But there's a problem here. You've got some nonlinearity. As I slide the polarization from purely vertical, full signal strength, toward horizontal, I'm issuing a E field in space that either does or doesn't get picked up by the receiving antenna. A purely horizontally polarized signal doesn't get picked up by a purely vertical receiving antenna. And the ratio that gets there is a cosine theta function. If I take the polarization angle and take the cosine of it, that predicts the voltage amplitude that I get at the receiving site. So as I approach horizontal degrees, cosine of 90 degrees is zero. I start going towards zero amplitude real fast. So if I plotted it logarithmically, it would have a real sharp dip in the receiver signal strength as they approach 90 degrees. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout.
So if I decided that I only wanted the not full 100% modulation, but only 50% modulation, I can get rid of some of that nonlinearity. So between two sites that are within line of sight, I could use this. And the strange thing about this is the transmitter is putting out a continuous CW, constant amplitude signal. At the receiver site, we'll see amplitude modulation as they rotate that polarization at the transmitting site. Electronically, I'm rotating that polarization. It would have to be electronically because mechanically you couldn't do it fast enough at the television video frequencies, for instance. But now let me show you the problems. The nonlinearity in the ideal layout is one of the problems. A huge problem is you've always got multipath. You think you've got line of sight between you and that signal 1 mile away. You look with your binoculars, you see the other antenna, you say, I've got perfect line of sight. You assume the signal does nothing but follow that line of sight. Absolutely not. The signal you're transmitting will bounce off of every single thing in that environment. The ground, the trees, the buildings, the water tower, the factory, everything is going to bounce. So the signal that gets received at the receiving site is a weird combination of all of those individual signal amplitudes with all those individual delay times because everything but the line of sight is a longer path, and you now have a significant amount of what's called chirality. Let me drop. If I choose a reflecting object, that's not purely horizontal or not purely vertical, but it's at a 45-degree angle with reference to the ground, and it's a non-direct path signal. In other words, I've got a signal that from the transmitting site is off to the left, so to speak, 30 degrees. And that object that's reflecting is the side of the building. It's a modern architecture building, and that side of the building is slanted at a 45-degree angle compared to the ground. The signal that bounces off of it can take a purely vertical transmitting signal, convert it to horizontal. What I'm getting at is because of the crazy multipath reflection characteristics of a real environment, you never get pure polarization at the receiving site. That's with line of sight. If the signal is over the horizon, non-line of sight, that problem gets a hell of a lot more complicated. So you think you're modulating the polarization, the polarimetry of the transmitting signal in order to modulate the amplitude of what the receiver is going to see. You're going to get something very different than what you expect for that particular receiving site. Another receiving site is going to see the signal entirely differently. What you think is an upward modulation to the first site, because of polarimetry and chirality, you're going to see a different modulation, a downward modulation at the other site. So for a whole bunch of reasons, you can make it work in a laboratory environment. In the real world, no, and I don't recommend it. It's a good-sounding idea. Let me drop it. Because in the old days of amplitude modulation, if I had a kilowatt amplitude modulated ham radio transmitter, and I'm using final stage high-level modulation, a kilowatt carrier signal requires 500 watts of audio to modulate that final stage. So ordinary amplitude modulation done in the conventional manner takes power. Whereas if I've got some electronic phase-shifting circuits built into the antenna that's doing polarimetry modulation, I could do it with a very small amount of power. At first, it looks like an advantage, but that receiving site, almost all of those receiving sites are not going to get a pure signal. They're going to see all kinds of ghosting and inverted modulations and so on, a negative signal instead of a positive signal. So in the real world, I think you don't want to do it. Drag your feet as they pass it over to you, Roy, but does it make a little bit more sense as to why it's not popular? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I liked when I got the question because it was one of those things that you don't generally think about. I kind of had the sense that it wasn't a practical thing because I figured if it was possible, there would be guys doing it and promoting it. So I thought the problem primarily for me was the line of sight communication. Anything else is going to bounce around. And I've had fun experiences talking with guys from Florida, where I have a vertical antenna that feeds my right ear and a horizontal that feeds my left, and I can hear the polarization rotating because of that, where he had a Yagi, and he just heard me fade in and out. So I have a real appreciation for polarization angles changing because they bounce into all manner of things.
Let me interrupt you on that one. When you're listening with left ear and right ear to horizontal and vertical, how fast would the signal rotate from one to the other? What's the fastest you've ever seen rotation and the slowest you've ever seen, Roy? Go ahead.
The fastest I've ever noticed is something like 10 minutes. It's a very gradual type of a phenomenon, at least when I've heard it. Sometimes it could be a half hour.
Yeah, that must have made some interesting receiving. Were there times where you're hearing half the amplitude of horizontal and half the amplitude of vertical, left and right ear, so to speak, and you're hearing some kind of an echo effect between the two? In other words, the timing was not exactly the same. Did it ever give you an echo-like effect, Roy?
No, I think the delay it was too small for my brain to calculate a difference in the signal. I would hear it kind of shifting from one ear to the other over the time span, but I never experienced reverb type of phenomena. So I think the difference in the signal speed was nominal.
I have on a couple of occasions on 432 megacycles heard a reverb-like effect. Occasionally you get a weird weather condition for 1 hour per year where all of a sudden you get an extremely strong signal between me and a guy that was 90 miles away in New Jersey by a non-direct path. The two of us aimed our antennas 10 degrees more to the west, so to speak, and we had a real strong signal, and the direct path between us almost disappeared, but we're seeing a real strong echo. And now I'm hearing a little bit of the weak direct path as well as the echo off of this, let me call it a reflecting cloud. And the timing between the two is such that the audio delay was enough difference that it sounded like a reverb, so to speak. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
That's interesting. I wonder what the length difference between the two paths need to be before they get through the threshold of recognizing two separate signals. I've never experienced that. My one case of that was in Florida. I haven't kind of repeated it lately because I spend way much too much time on 10 meters, and 10 meters is a very, very local frequency these days.
Since the speed of light is a nanosecond per foot, if there was 1,000 foot more distance on the indirect path, 1,000 nanoseconds is a microsecond, that wouldn't do it. You need something closer to a millisecond to really hear echo. Huh. What was I really hearing is an interesting question. It sounds to me like it's going to require 1,000 feet is not going to do it. 1,000,000 feet will do it. 1,000,000 feet is how many miles? I guess that's 20 or 30 miles. Could there have been that many more miles by the indirect path? I'm not sure. I'm going to have to review the mathematics on that one now, Roy. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, you do that. I mean, I would think that it would have to take a real long path home. I mean, it's really going out of its way for something that at least my ears can recognize as two separate signals.
Yeah, a millisecond of delay is something like 190 miles. No, he and I were only 90 miles apart, so where was the echo coming from is a darn interesting question. Go ahead, Roy.
It's another one of those great radio mysteries that hopefully someday someone will figure completely out. Radio does amazing things, and it still surprises people, and that's what gives some of them the thrill that they don't quite know what will happen tomorrow. That's why amateur radio operators don't just talk on the Internet, where the connections are rather stable, and they don't change. you like to play gambling a little bit. There's a challenge in that, and that's what we all see in radio, I think.